From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA congressional correspondent Cindy Sain. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Congressman Jeff Fortenberry, a Republican from the Midwestern state of Nebraska. And we're coming to you from his office on Capitol Hill. Congressman Fortenberry has served for over 10 years in the House of Representatives. He is a member of the powerful Appropriations Committee. He serves on three subcommittees, Energy and Water, Military Construction and Veterans Affairs, and State and Foreign Operations. Congressman Fortenberry previously served on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, focusing particularly on human rights, Middle Eastern affairs, and nuclear weapons nonproliferation. In 2010, Foreign Policy magazine listed him as a Republican foreign policy power broker for his committee actions related to nuclear security. Congressman Fortenberry is also co-chair of the Religious Minorities in the Middle East Caucus, seeking justice and protection for minority groups such as the Yazidis, a minority in Iraq. In that vein, he and Congresswoman Anna Eshoo, a Democrat from the state of California, in September 2015, formally recognized actions committed against minorities in Iraq and Syria by the so-called Islamic State as acts of genocide. In a sign of overwhelming bipartisan unity, the resolution recently passed unanimously with a vote of 393-0. By law, the State Department must make a genocide determination by March 17th. Well, we'll talk with Congressman Fortenberry about the significance and implications of this resolution, as well as his views on a variety of pressing foreign policy and national security issues in this important election year. Congressman Fortenberry, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you. And thank you for the kind introduction.
And well, thank you for hosting us here on the Hill. And as always, I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Cindy Sain.
Pleasure.
Well, Congressman Fortenberry, let's talk about this very important resolution that you introduced and which was passed unanimously. I understand that you represent America's largest Yazidi community in Nebraska.
I do. Isn't that interesting? A number of members of the Yazidi communities worked with our troops at the height of the Iraq War. They were translators. And because of their valiant service, because many of them put themselves in grave danger, there were special provisions made in law to allow them to have visas and citizenship in the United States. Interestingly, through and convergence of factors, many Yazidis settled in my hometown of Lincoln, Nebraska. Known the community for many years prior to this horrific assault that's occurred on them, this systematic attempt to exterminate the Yazidi ancient faith tradition as well as the Christian tradition that is occurring in Iraq as well as in Syria and the ISIS-held areas. The community is very grateful to be here in America. About a year and a half ago, I had a number of the young men who had served as translators come to see me. Their mothers, their sisters, their family members were trapped on Mount Sinjar. You may remember the incident. Thousands. And they were in dire need, and they were under threat of being murdered by ISIS. They were pleading with me passionately, on the verge of tears, angry. And I don't blame them for being angry. Congressman, please do something. Please help us. The time is now. We cannot hesitate. They took their case to Washington, and shortly thereafter, the U.S. campaign to stop ISIS by air power started and saved the people on Mount Sinjar. So the Yazidi community, even though it's a small community, I'm proud to represent them. I met a gentleman just the other night, by the way, who was one of those translators, and he returned to Sinjar, which has now been liberated. It's still dangerous, but it has been liberated. And he went to his birthplace, where he grew up, and the Christian church, which was next door to where he grew up, is a pile of rubble. Taking it upon himself, he hand-fashioned a wooden cross and placed it on top of that pile of rubble, telling me, these were my brothers. I ate with them. I played with them. He stands in solidarity with the other ancient faith tradition in the Nineveh Plain there that had contributed so richly to the diverse tapestry of religious tradition in the Middle East. One of the reasons that this genocide resolution is so important is that when there is a systematic attempt to exterminate another group of people, it's not only an injustice, it's an assault on human dignity and therefore a threat to civilization itself. So I'm very proud of the House of Representatives for unanimously passing this. It's very hard to pass anything, much less do it unanimously, but it is a clear statement of resolve by the House of Representatives to label this what it is, a genocide against Christians, Yazidis, and other faith traditions. And by the way, I should add that ISIS's, the persons that they've killed the most, have been innocent Muslims.
Congressman Fortenberry, I'm really speechless, you know, with your very eloquent explanation of what led you to introduce this resolution. And we all take note of the crimes against humanity taking place against these minorities who are part and parcel of the mosaic of the Middle East, Christians, Yazidis, and others. Well, let me turn now to my colleague, Cindy Sain, to follow up.
Congressman, now that the House has passed this resolution unanimously, where do we go from here?
I'm hopeful that the Senate takes similar action quickly. There have been previous attempts to do so. There is a new effort underway by my colleague, Senator Sass from Nebraska as well, to reintroduce a new resolution that parallels the one that was passed in the House. It's not just the opinion of the House of Representatives. This proposition has been advanced by the International Association of Genocide Scholars, our own Commission on Religious Freedom, which is in the State Department, Genocide Watch, the Yazidi international community, Pope Francis, presidential candidates from both sides of the aisle. It is clear, the facts are in, this is genocide. I want to be respectful of the State Department's processes, legal processes for determining this, but I've felt like it's been my obligation to not just present facts, but also to plea.
I wanted also to ask you about the issue of refugees from the Middle East. The House has passed legislation to make it more difficult for refugees from Iraq and Syria to be admitted, and a new bill is also now going through the, I believe, the Judiciary Committee to make it even more difficult. Do you see any contradiction in the House passing resolution declaring that ISIS is committing genocide and also saying that the Syrian regime is committing war crimes and their allies, and this issue of making it more difficult to bring in refugees from the same area?
Well, let's sort through the complexity of your question, which is a good one. First of all, the United States, as I recall roughly, is spending about $1 billion, and no one knows this, or very few people know this, on assistance to refugee communities, persons who have had to flee to Jordan, to Turkey, to Lebanon, other refugee areas, due to, again, the collapse of really the nation-state order in Syria particularly, but also in areas of Iraq. We are aggressively pursuing our values, which start with humanitarian outreach. It is very hard for Americans to sit idly by while other people just die. So that's the first order priority, to try to help people where they are, to keep them alive, in effect, and sustain, in the hope that once there is some type of security settlement, they can return to the areas that they're from. I mean, there's an absorptive capacity in terms of migration. As you are very much aware, the immigration debate is very much alive in the United States as to whether or not our current structures of law properly vet potential migrants to the country for security reasons, to the heart of your question. So that's really the more of the debate about placing additional limitations and structural security measures on potential immigrants to America. The genocide resolution does have particular meaning when it comes to migration for emergency purposes. For instance, if this is declared by the State Department, you may see more prioritization given to those who are in severe threat of having their life eliminated. So it's a bit of a separate issue from whether or not our security screening measures are appropriate, which the House and Senate, with my support, have passed to ensure that persons that are being let into America are not here to do harm. That is a legitimate concern. On the other side of it, combine that with direct humanitarian assistance and some migration flow with the potential prioritization for those who are under the severe threat of death. I don't see an inconsistency in that. In fact, I see that as being very consistent to make sure we have an orderly and just immigration process.
Congressman Fortenberry, notwithstanding the atrocities committed by the so-called Islamic State, also known as ISIL or ISIS, what about Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's atrocities? You know, some argue that he is a state sponsor of terror, equally, if not more dangerous, than the heinous non-state actors such as is a so-called Islamic State, and that because he is head of state, you know, and he has legitimacy presumably in the eyes of the United Nations, that he, in fact, has aided and abetted the crimes against humanity by ISIS and has committed them, of course, himself through his barrel bombing of citizens and actually targeting the mainstream opposition rebels as even opposed to ISIS. Now, I do note that your colleague, Ed Royce, the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, did introduce Resolution 269. We also note that that resolution, which basically passed also with a vote of 392-3, condemning the gross violations of international law amounting to war crimes and crimes against humanity by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's regime, its allies, and other parties to the Syrian conflict. Do you support that as well, and do you see it as an important corollary to Resolution 75?
Yes, and I feel like the way that the context for the introduction of the question was absolutely correct. One of the reasons that the resolutions ran in parallel was that there is specifically a genocide situation, which is somewhat distinct from the nation-state terror that's been led by Bashar al-Assad. But nonetheless, the result is the same. Innocent people die. To have commingled, though, the issues takes away what is a systematic attempt to exterminate Christian Yazidis and other religious minorities from, again, the entangled, horrific conflict itself in Syria. That is a fight between warring factions. This is why both resolutions ran concurrently but separately. Now, the question in the short term becomes, how do you ensure that there is some viable security, political, even economic and cultural settlement in Syria, ensuring that there is a proper transition for the president out of the country without leaving a vacuum in the country that worse forces such as ISIL could potentially fill? This is the delicate, complex dynamic. We have stated clearly the crimes that the president of Syria has committed against his own people, and yet at the same time have to hold this in a delicate balance so that the entire state does not collapse and potentially become worse for innocent Syrians as well. That's the nuance and the difficulties of such a complex situation.
Absolutely, Congressman. And we note that Secretary of State John Kerry is supposed to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin next week, and talks will continue in that vein. Of course, we note that Moscow has begun to pull out some troops and air force, but we have yet to see, you know, really, if that's the case and what impact that will have. We'll be right back, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Congressman Jeff Fortenberry, Republican from the Midwestern state of Nebraska, and we're coming to you from his office on Capitol Hill. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA congressional correspondent Cindy Sain. And this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Vyacheslav Lavrinov from Russia. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on Facebook. Well, now a question from Cindy.
Switching areas of the world, if I could, Congressman. President Barack Obama is heading to Cuba soon for a historic visit. A number of lawmakers from both sides of the aisle are criticizing him, saying human rights abuses by the Castro government are continuing. Do you think the president should be making the trip at this time?
Cuba is one of those another complex, difficult problem areas whereby we have a proximity to the country. We have many Cuban Americans who had to flee with only the clothes on their back, whose property was confiscated by the Cuban regime decades ago, and then since then put in place a policy where there has been a relatively strict embargo, ongoing tensions between the two countries. I don't think there is anyone here who doesn't look forward to the day in which the United States and Cuba are not just physical neighbors, but neighbors in the sense of having some type of healthy interaction, maybe even an interdependency, as we do with so many other countries in the vicinity. The difficulty becomes the legacy problem of so many Americans having been treated so brutally and unjustly by the Castro regime, and not empowering that regime to continue that behavior into the future. That was the original logic of the embargoes and such. I was talking with someone yesterday about the potential of visiting there. I think that movement toward more openness and dialogue is important. But we can't hide from harsh realities that are still present, namely the repression of human rights activists who are in Cuba, the issue of reparations to people who had everything stripped from them. How do we move forward with urging the country to develop systems of governance that protect human dignity and rights and the basic freedoms that we enjoy? We can't just sort of put those off to the side. If we are going to move forward in some sort of rapprochement, you have to be willing to pull in the hard conversations and seek creative ways to demand change. It's delicate. It's complex. Once again, we're carrying forward difficult, painful legacies for many Americans. And yet, at the same time, stagnating where we are isn't the answer either. Further empowering, though, potential injustice, we have to be very watchful thereof.
I think Chairman Royce has said that if the president is going now, that he should meet with human rights activists and use the trip to leverage some of the U.S. influence. Is that how you feel?
I would suggest that's perfectly appropriate. The administration has stated that they continue to press the Cubans in this regard. But again, if there's going to be an opening, let's pursue the fullness of an opening and not push aside the difficult dynamics that still exist in that country.
Are you hearing from farmers in your state who would welcome closer ties with Cuba?
Of course, but I've had the same conversation with them. And in fact, I had a farmer sitting right where you are one day and said, you know, I said, Jeff, you've given us a fuller perspective on this. We're tending to only think narrowly through the potential for economic benefit, but you've given us a broader perspective that's very important. Look, in general, farmers, certainly where I live, are good Americans. And trade policies and other economic benefits, when there are higher callings, such as pursuing basic human goods of justice, farmers know that's a priority, that's important.
Indeed. Well, in that vein, Congressman Fortenberry, we do note that very few Republicans do support this opening to Cuba, precisely because of the human rights abuses. On the other hand, your colleague, Republican Senator Jeff Flake from the state of Arizona, has been one of the lone voices, Republican voices, and precisely because, partly because, economic ties can be seen, you know, as an impetus toward greater openings. So the argument being not to in any way ignore or not press for these important changes in human rights, but by the same token, greater opening through trade ties perhaps could promote greater political opening and a way to promote human rights in Cuba.
Senator Flake and I are good friends, and we served together in the House of Representatives before he went to the other body, as we call it. He has always taken that decided perspective. And again, it's a matter of judgment. Has the policy, which is being roundly criticized, that's been in place again for decades, has it potentially led to this moment whereby the Castro family's intentions of spreading their revolution had actually been contained? That's harder to measure. Had we just ignored that and had liberalized trade policies, would that have extended their ability to affect other countries as they had in Venezuela? They were even moving into Africa, as you recall earlier. You can argue this either way. Did we contain their ability to grow their revolution through these policies? Are we at a moment whereby the openness is giving a chance for enhanced dialogue without potentially enhanced economic activity, without potentially furthering the earlier Castro regime's aims? Hard judgment calls have to be made. And so I think you take it slowly. You, again, put the human rights issue front and center as you move toward more liberalization of person-to-person ties. I think that's the smartest thing to do, the easiest thing to measure, and is the best way to build what we all hope for, is better integrated ties with the country once it solves this very painful past human rights difficulties that it has, which is, I shouldn't say past, it's ongoing.
Of course, others who support the president's policy of greater opening diplomatic ties also say that the United States has improved its image and clout with all the countries of Latin America who've been waiting for this day, so that may be a potential benefit as well.
Yeah, undoubtedly.
May we turn briefly to Iran, the nuclear deal, and recently we've noted that the Iranians have launched, you know, ballistic missiles, and of course the administration is going to the UN to propose a resolution calling upon Iran not to undertake any activity related to ballistic missiles designed to be capable of delivering nuclear weapons, including launches using this type of ballistic missile technology. Where do you stand with respect to this approach by the administration, and what more can be done to contain Iran?
Yes, we have to be very careful. Clearly, there are deep divides and tensions with the Iranians. Their intentions are complex in the region. When you have their military riding on the side of a missile, this is for Israel or whatever they said, this is not helpful in terms of their seemingly desire to integrate into more of a responsible position in international affairs. It also points to maybe perhaps some dynamics inside of Iran that we don't understand, because we have a transparent system. They have a system where there are multiple power sources and multiple dynamics. There might be hardliners within the military who are very intent upon disrupting this earlier agreement regarding the march toward nuclear weapons. They may not be able to be controlled by other elements in the government that we have agreed. I didn't vote for the agreement, I should make note of that, because of concerns about lifting the arms embargo and certain ballistic missile technologies as well. That was one of the reasons that I did not support it. But we can't be too quick to, again, throw the doors open to celebration. Now, with that said, it is important that Iran not be allowed to obtain nuclear weapons during the debate about the agreement, to try, in all fairness, to have information gathering sessions about the potential upsides of the agreement and the severe risk to the agreement, by pointing to, again, slowing the march or potentially reversing what was a real march toward nuclear weapons capacity. It's one of the benefits of the agreement. Creating some sort of change of circumstances in which there is more openness in the country, which, again, gives us additional opportunity to monitor their activities, and also gives us the ability to go to track two, if you will, whereby you develop people-to-people exchange, conditions for better mutual understanding. That earlier pathway was not sustainable. So those were the upsides of the agreement. The downsides were it left certain components of the nuclear weapons infrastructure in place. It lifted an arms embargo, and there were ballistic missile technology implications, as I recall. So we're living in a murky time with what the future of the Iranian relationship to the rest of the world is. It's my hope that, from what I understand and my own experience has been, the Iranian people are really inclined toward better relations with the West. The revolution and then the strictures that came about after their 79 revolution that has been so devastating to so many people in terms of human rights. I have a very good friend of mine. He sold me the family van. His two nieces are in prison in Iran because they practice the Baha'i faith. 21 years old. A peace-loving faith tradition there. They're simply in jail because of that faith tradition. There's a long way to go. The heart of your question, the launch of the ballistic missiles is a sad, complicating factor, and it impacts, again, this nuclear agreement because it creates more uncertainty as to what Iranian intentions really are.
Congressman Fortenberry, you've really laid out the complexity very eloquently. And I think both the supporters and detractors of the nuclear agreement would agree that the United States can and perhaps must do more to try to contain Iran's activities in the region, since the nuclear deal was the nuclear deal and there was no restrictions regarding what the United States could or couldn't do on other issues of Iran's hegemony in the region.
New sanctions have been put on the Iranians, by the way, for the launch of the ballistic missiles. So again, the issue of sanctions, because the United States has such power within the worldwide financial system, can have impact. So it's one of the tools that we have to try to constrain behavior and give incentive toward, again, what we would desire for an Iran that reintegrates back into the responsible communities of the world.
Congressman, as we close, we have just two more domestic-oriented questions, if you'd be so kind. With regard to the Supreme Court nomination, just this week, President Obama has actually proposed a nominee, Chief Federal Judge Merrick Garland, from the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., has been put forth. Now, we do note that the Republican-controlled Congress has vowed not to hold hearings. The Judiciary Committee chair has said that no hearings will be held, regardless of the nominee. Do you support this position that no hearing should be held on a nominee by President Obama?
We're living in an age where Supreme Court nominees are a reflection of the ideology of the president. That's just a reality. Congress is an independent branch of government and has its own authority. And if I'm not in the Senate, if the Senate decides that they're not going to hold hearings, that's their business. But I would say that Vice President Biden, when he was in the United States Senate, and as I understand President Obama himself, argued against late in the presidential term appointments to the Supreme Court. In other words, empowering the electorate of the country to determine the ideological direction of the government, particularly when it's right around the corner. We have an election right around the corner that will decide a lot in this country. The philosophical disposition of America is really up for grabs.
Well, certainly, because the court is split now, because Justice Scalia, who recently passed away, was very conservative.
Which makes the question all the more intense as to what direction the court is going to take because it is so divided. I should add that I knew Justice Scalia. In fact, he and I hunted together in Nebraska, western Nebraska, in December of this year. I had this extraordinary privilege of getting to know this man on a more intimate level. I mean, when you spend 2 days in a duck blind with somebody, that's a bonding experience. So I called our mutual friend and asked, would it be all right to speak about him more publicly, the way I knew him more personally? And he said, oh, yeah, please do. So I was pleased that I was able to offer some comments just to the general public about the incredible character of this man, who had a deep sense of legal precedent, was a student of our history, had very strong intellectual acumen, but I think applied his principles so consistently that even the people who disagreed with him, he won their respect. This is what I think ought to be the hope for America, that we rebuild the institutions of our country that give rise to beautifully formed men and women who are compelled to become statesmen. That's one of the ingredients that I think we all ought to be reflecting on in the wake of the death of Justice Scalia and then the difficult political fights that are going to be ahead as to whoever is nominated.
No question about it. Well, let me give the last word to my colleague, Cindy Sain.
Turning to the election that's going on, which has been unprecedented in many respects, we are seeing a very unusual battle, of course, on the Republican side, with Donald Trump looking more likely to win the nomination, but many saying that they're afraid that he does not have the qualifications or the temperament to be president. Could you weigh in on how you see this?
About a year ago, I had a conversation with someone named Carly Fiorina. I had called her because I found her to be an interesting person, and I like to invite interesting persons to Nebraska to come to speak. We had a very impactful conversation about what she called the disquiet in the country. And the issue really is this, that the current economic and political and cultural settlement has left so many people feeling helpless, disconnected, vulnerable, in many ways angry. And that anger, that fear, that sense of vulnerability, that the country is dynamically changing and it's beyond the control of any one person to do anything about it, is really the underlying dynamic, the undercurrent of the entire election. I was impressed by her answer, by that conversation. We were both sharing similar sentiments. I decided to support Carly Fiorina. She gained some momentum. Unfortunately, that momentum didn't continue, and so she dropped out of the race after New Hampshire. Now, as we are shaking this out, you've got to let the election process work itself out. It isn't always pretty. It's not going to be exactly what I would prefer. But again, this deep sense of helplessness and vulnerability in the light of changing circumstances in the country that have left so many people behind is driving many people, many for the first time, to be involved in this election.
Congressman Jeff Fortenberry is a Republican from the state of Nebraska. Congressman Fortenberry, thank you so much for your time, sharing your insights on so many important international issues.
Pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Gary Jaffe. And joining me on the program was VOA congressional correspondent Cindy Sain. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.